May it please the court. My name is Mark Evans, number 40156, public defender, and I'm here today representing Mr. Gerald McFarland. When the state of Colorado brings criminal charges against one of its citizens, that citizen has the right to present evidence in his defense and have a jury apply that evidence to the law. Now here, the El Paso County District Court correctly determined that Mr. McFarland was entitled to raise the affirmative defense of involuntary intoxication. However, it then deprived him of the ability to present critical evidence in support of that defense and never required the jury to evaluate whether that evidence, when applied to the elements of the crimes charged, excused him from criminal liability. Those errors worked together to make it more difficult for Mr. McFarland to assert involuntary intoxication and thereby lower the state's burden of proof. I'm happy to talk about any aspect of this case today. However, I'm planning to focus my time on the district court's refusal to admit defense evidence tending to show that Mr. McFarland had experienced another episode of involuntary intoxication the month before the charged offenses. Mr. McFarland's defense to all of the charges was that by reason of intoxication brought about by an adverse reaction to validly prescribed medications, he lacked the capability to conform his conduct to the requirements of law. And once that defense was raised, any evidence having any tendency to make it more likely that he was having an adverse reaction at the time of the charged offenses was relevant and admissible, except as otherwise provided by law.
And the except as otherwise provided is Rule 403?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
What he sought to introduce was evidence that approximately 6 weeks before the charged offenses, he was pulled over by police. As was the case here, he was driving erratically, he was not able to properly respond to questions, and he was very agitated. And the police thought he was drunk. They arrested him for DUI. But at that time, he was not, however, under the influence of alcohol, nor was he under the influence of any drugs commonly associated with impairment. Rather, he was taking these same prescription medications as he was at the time of the charged offenses.
Counsel, can I interrupt you quickly on that point? What is the evidence with respect to that earlier incident 6 weeks earlier? What is the evidence that the defendant was taking the prescribed medications and that's what caused his behavior?
Your Honor, that was by way of an offer of proof from Mr. McFarland and his counsel on May 17th when the judge specifically asked whether his sister would be able to testify to the effect that he was taking the same medications at both times, and he said that evidence would be presented.
Thank you.
So just so I'm clear, it would have been the sister's testimony, not any other witness, including the defendant himself, of course, didn't have to testify if he didn't want to.
That's correct, Your Honor. But what complicates the situation here is that had the district court not ruled as it did, and the question I'm anticipating here is why didn't he testify to that effect?
Well, or are there any other witnesses? It's the sister we're talking about, right?
The sister is the one who would have provided that evidence.
The link that Judge Navarro was talking about in terms of he was using these prescription medications at that time.
That's correct. And counsel would have been prohibited by the court's ruling by attempting to establish that link through examination of Mr. McFarland because the court had already ruled that evidence was inadmissible.
Thank you.
The evidence at issue here was relevant and was admissible for at least two reasons. First, it made it more likely that the medications that Mr. McFarland was taking, both at the time of the prior incident and at the time of the charged offenses, could render him unable to conform his conduct to the requirements of law. Second, it made it less likely that he was intoxicated by alcohol at the time of the charged offenses because it provided an explanation for behavior that would otherwise appear very much like alcohol intoxication.
Well, let me follow up on that, please, counsel, because how does it actually make it less likely that he was not intoxicated with alcohol? I understand it could be an alternative explanation, but the reason that the trial court excluded it was because there's no logical way to discern just because these intoxicants that he was taking could have had this effect on him, that he wasn't also intoxicated by alcohol. Help me with that, please.
Your Honor, that's really the crux of the argument. The the trial court's belief that there is no logical way that those two things could support one another. But if Mr. McFarland was acting in a certain way where police had determined that he was not intoxicated, and then, and under circumstances where they had originally thought that he was, because he was exhibiting those signs, at a later date, if he has another encounter with police and he is acting in the same way and the police again believe that he is intoxicated, but this time they have no chemical testing information to prove it one way or another, that evidence makes it more likely that he was not drinking at the time of the second offense. And the standard,
I'm having trouble with that link, counsel. Right. That logical
and again,
link is missing for me.
The standard under CRE 401 is that it simply has to have any tendency to make any fact of consequence more or less likely.
Well, isn't it possible that the drugs, that on the date that he was charged, that he was taking the drugs and also was intoxicated and could have had the same behaviors? So how could it negate the possibility that he also was intoxicated voluntarily through alcohol?
It doesn't absolutely negate it, but it makes it less likely. And that is the same.
How does it make it less likely?
It's because because it illustrates that he is a person with a medical condition that puts him in a position where he is prone to exhibiting behaviors that would cause a police officer to think that he was intoxicated by alcohol. But that behavior can be caused by some other thing. And that's really all that's important here. It illustrates that he can, by all appearances, be drunk, close enough appearances to be arrested for DUI, but yet we all know, and it's not disputed, that he was not drunk at that time. So that provides an explanation for behaviors that otherwise would appear to be caused by alcohol intoxication. But again, Your Honor, even if you don't agree that it is in any way relevant for that limited purpose, it is certainly relevant as to whether or not the medications he was taking are capable of rendering him incapable of conforming his conduct to the requirements of law. And either one of those, I mean, under either one of those rationales, the evidence should have come in. And I think it's also important to recognize the other ground that defense counsel recognized at that May 17th hearing, that the evidence also would have countered the jury's anticipated perception that involuntary intoxication was a kind of a made-up defense for purposes of that trial, and that is, societally speaking, a difficult defense to swallow. And to have a concrete instance to point to and say, no, this has happened before. And of course, it's ultimately the jury's question whether they buy that that's what happened on May 7th. But to say, here is evidence of a prior incident, that does make it more likely, or could make it more likely in the mind of a rational juror, that at the time of the charged offenses, he was suffering from an adverse effect from medications.
So let me make sure I have the facts right. In the prior incident, there was no evidence that he was under the influence of alcohol, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. But in the charged offenses, he was. Is that correct? He had been drinking.
Your Honor, that was highly disputed at trial. I mean, and that's why this evidence was so critical to go to the jury. There was no blood or breath test performed in this case. And, you know, it was disputed whether or not he admitted that he had had alcoholic beverages or whether he was talking about non-alcoholic beverages. It was disputed, you know, how the signs of his behavior should be interpreted. So all of that was a jury question. And in order to decide that question accurately, the jury had to have all of the relevant information. That's why it was so critical to get this in.
But just so I understand the difference between the two incidents, if there are any, in this first incident, that the 6 months, 6 weeks earlier, the uncharged incident, there wasn't any evidence that he smelled of alcohol or admitted to having a few drinks. I mean, that's a difference between the earlier incident and the charged incident, correct?
Your Honor, because the district court made the decision that the evidence was inadmissible, we have no idea.
Okay.
All we have is the representation made in the motion that he was exhibiting the same behaviors and that he was affirmatively determined to be not intoxicated. and we have the representations by counsel to the same effect. I mean, had the court allowed that evidence in or, you know, taken the evidence outside of the presence of the jury, then we might have answers to that question, but we don't.
Thank you.
And it was, in the end, I mean, the error on the trial court's part was saying this doesn't come in because it does not prove what he did or did not consume. That's not the standard. It's not what did it prove, it's what did it make more or less likely. And because that evidence was the only evidence from a disinterested party confirming that he could exhibit certain behaviors in the absence of voluntary intoxication, failure to allow him to present that evidence was constitutional error.
It wasn't the only evidence, was it? He had an expert witness who testified, didn't he?
That's correct, Your Honor. Dr. James did testify, and Dr. James was able to indicate that some of the medications that he was taking could impact him in an adverse way. However, that was in a hypothetical sense. It was not a specific instance, and certainly Dr. James did not bring in that he was acting in the same type of way, that he was exhibiting these same symptoms under conditions where he had undergone a 10-panel drug screen and found to be clean. If there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Can you, before I let you go, can you just take a few seconds and talk about the 403 analysis here and tell us how you get from point A to point B?
Your Honor, I think it's important to note that I don't believe the district court did a 403 analysis here. I think that was strictly a 401 ruling. Viewed under 403, obviously the rule strongly prefers the admission of evidence, and the court has to assign that the maximum probative value and the minimum probative value. I think I've done my best to try to explain the probative value here, and for the life of me, I don't know how it would be somehow prejudicial to the state other than by being exculpatory evidence for my client, which is certainly not prejudicial on those grounds. Nor was it cumulative to anything that Dr. James testified to, as I just talked about, nor was it cumulative to anything that Mr. McFarland testified to.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
You've got a little less than 3 minutes for any rebuttal you would like.
May it please the court, Will Kozlowski, registration number 37824, on behalf of the people. I'd like to start with, I disagree with Mr. Evans, I read the court's ruling as a 403 ruling. He first says that whether or not Mr. McFarland might have had a reaction to his medication on the prior occasion can be addressed by Mr. James or Dr. James. He can testify to the effects of the medications. And then he says the fact that he may have, it goes to Judge Terry's question, I agree with Mr. Evans that it makes it more likely that he was under the effects of his prescription medications, but it doesn't make it less likely that he was under the effects of alcohol on the charged offense. And I think clearly the court's statement that the evidence was too attenuated and not likely to prove a material issue is a 403 analysis, in essence.
Is it a 403 analysis, or is it just saying it's not relevant under 401?
I read it as a 403 analysis because I think it's pretty clear that it's relevant, that in that it makes it more likely that he was under the effects of his prescription medications, but that the most probative evidence on that issue would be provided by Dr. James, who could testify to the effects of the medications.
So what were the prejudicial effects, or what was the danger of prejudice that the trial court was worried about?
I don't think it was a danger of unfair prejudice, it's just that it was too attenuated from the charged offense, and that defendant could call his expert and it would be much more probative on that issue, and it would be an undue, I mean, I acknowledge that the trial court didn't say an undue waste of time, but I think that's implicit in its ruling that we're going to have a witness that's going to testify to the effects of his medication, and that will suffice, essentially.
So you think the court ruled that the probative value of the evidence was substantially outweighed by the waste of time that would occur by presenting the evidence the defendant wanted to present?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Did the court, in that regard, did either the court or any arguments to the court talk about jury confusion?
Yes, the prosecutor specifically argued that it would confuse the jury.
Okay.
And I'd also like to mention that defendant testified to this incident during his testimony, so the evidence was presented to the jury.
Well, how did that happen?
If
the judge had excluded this testimony.
Well, the judge excluded, and I think this demonstrates the correctness of the judge's ruling, is that he precluded the police officers and I think a lab expert from saying, you know, I pulled over the defendant and he was agitated.
And apparently the sister too couldn't testify.
I didn't read defendant's motion to have the sister testify as saying she would testify as to the prior incident. I read that as just generally she was going to testify that he took his medications regularly and that he had symptoms related to taking those medications. Judge Navarro, as to your question, I don't believe there was any evidence in the prior incident that he was under the influence of alcohol in the sense of an odor or saying that he admitted to drinking or to having a few drinks. And Mr. Evans says that we don't know. Well, it was not part of any of the defendant's offer of proof, which I think this court is limited to analyzing the defendant's offer of proof, which is he was agitated and couldn't follow directions. I'd like to turn to, even assuming that the trial court erred in precluding this testimony, it was harmless. First, as I mentioned, it was cumulative to defendant's testimony. He testified concerning this specific incident with the police. It was cumulative to Dr. James' testimony in the sense of defendant argues that I needed a disinterested witness to tell people that I could be involuntarily intoxicated as a result of my prescription medications. Dr. James did that. The defendant was hospitalized for 3 days, and I believe he said he was hospitalized on five previous occasions where no alcohol or intoxicating drugs were found in his system. So I don't believe it was ever disputed that this could happen to the defendant. It was just that the prosecution's theory was that he drank on this occasion. He admitted it to the police. He smelled of alcohol, and that on this occasion, he was voluntarily intoxicated. In addition, the jury's analysis of the involuntary intoxication in the sense of did he drink or not would not be affected by this evidence at all. If the jury concluded that he drank that night, then his involuntary intoxication defense failed. And there's no dispute that he raises the instructional issue, but assuming the instructions were okay, there's no dispute that the jury would be able to analyze the evidence of whether he drank alcohol that night, and this evidence had nothing to do with that.
Well, counsel, can I ask you a little bit more about that?
Sure.
If the jury thought he drank, then this other evidence that was included wouldn't really shed light on that issue, but it seemed to be assuming the jury might find that he drank. I mean, the evidence of his intoxication, as I understand it, was that his behavior, he was agitated, not following directions, was belligerent. And if that same behavior was consistent with him having a bad reaction to his prescription, why doesn't evidence that he had, that he exhibited that same behavior as a result of his prescription, why wouldn't that be relevant to the jury's determination about whether this behavior was a result of alcohol versus something else?
I agree it is relevant. I think the court precluded it under...
So you think it meets a 401 relevance? So your argument is entirely on 403?
Yes, yes, absolutely. My argument is just that the court was correct in its 403 analysis, and even assuming it wasn't, the main issue for the jury was what was the cause of the intoxication. It was the prosecution's theory that he had drank that night, and he admitted to police officers that he had a few drinks. He testified that he meant coffee on that occasion. The officers both smelled alcohol on him. He testified that was icy hot. So the determinations of the jury of those issues, this evidence had nothing to do with that, and that's why it's harmless. In addition, Dr. James' testimony was not really in defendant's favor. He suspected that the defendant was a chronic alcoholic, and the cause of his hospitalizations on prior occasions was likely narcotic and alcohol abuse withdrawal. And finally, I'd like to point out that I think this evidence was harmless largely because involuntary intoxication was largely contrary to defendant's own testimony. He got up and testified that he said he had trouble remembering parts, but he said he didn't grab the victim of the attempted kidnapping. He never told her to get in the car. He drove away. He was scared of the second of the alleged menacing victims. And even though he knew he couldn't drive, he decided to drive. So there was his own testimony contradicted the fact that he couldn't conform his conduct to the law. This court has no further questions. I ask that you affirm defendant's convictions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Evans, you have a little bit of time for rebuttal if you'd like it.
Your Honor, unless I heard something, I heard the AG state that the evidence of the prior incident was relevant to whether Mr. McFarland was under the effect of his prescription medications at the time of the charged incident, and that it was relevant to whether or not he was intoxicated. His intoxication was an element of, if nothing else, drinking and driving. Whether he was under the effects of his prescription medications was an element of the affirmative defense. I think that it's been made clear in Bueno, in Golob, in Munoz, that when you deny a defendant the opportunity to provide exculpatory information directly relevant to an element, not only has error occurred, but it's constitutional error and it requires reversal.
But even under Bueno, you still have to show relevance and meet the 403 test, right? You don't have to meet all the SPOTO requirements, but you still have to meet basic evidentiary rules for relevance, don't you?
That's correct, Your Honor. The 403 analysis, of course, still applies. And of course, it's the Attorney General's position that this evidence was covered by both Dr. James and Mr. McFarland. I think I've already talked about Dr. James. I think it's important to recognize that Mr. McFarland's testimony, the whole extent of that was, I was picked up for DWAI before, and they dismissed the charges because there were no drugs or alcohol found in his system. That testimony did not include the date of the prior charge, the fact that he was driving erratically, the fact that he couldn't answer questions coherently. All of the behaviors that make this relevant were not included in his testimony, nor was the fact that he had undergone a 10-panel drug screen. So,
counsel, was he precluded from testifying to those facts?
Your Honor, defense counsel was prohibited from asking about it, okay. And the prosecutor didn't ask about it. He just kind of blurted that out.
Okay, thank you.
So, yes, he was prohibited from testifying. And I think it's important to recognize that there is a big, big difference between what is essentially a self-serving recollection of prior events on behalf of my client and having a police officer and state laboratory technicians come in and testify to the condition that he was in. And when analyzing the effect of that testimony, this court is required to grant it the maximum probative value. And I don't think, aside from the argument that it's cumulative, which as we've discussed is incorrect, I don't think there's even been an allegation of prejudice here against the state. I recognize I'm running out of time here. I would just like to conclude by saying that we all get sick. We get prescribed medications that by design alter our mental and physical capabilities. And sometimes people do things on medications that they wouldn't normally do. And when that happens, they have the right to present a defense. They have the right to have it evaluated. My client was deprived of that right, and I respectfully ask this court to reverse his conviction. Thank you for your time this afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. Case will stand submitted. Divisional issue and opinion in due course.